You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. Today I'm speaking with Therese Keane, who is the deputy chair at the Department of Education based in the School of Social Sciences, Media, Film and Education at Swinburne University of Technology here in Melbourne, Australia. Her passion and many achievements in IT have been acknowledged by her peers, and she has received several Australian, national and state awards. Her commitment to education is indicative of her involvement providing professional development to ICT teachers and research into the use of technology, gender inequalities in STEM-based subjects, robotics in education, and computers in schools for teaching and learning purposes. I would like to say hello and welcome to Therese. How are you this morning?
I'm very well, thank you.
How long have you worked at Swinburne, and what are your special research or teaching areas of interest?
Oh, wonderful question, Lisa. I've been at Swinburne since 2011, so that almost places me there for about 11 and a half years. I might even take a step back, actually, if that's okay, and say that I've been in schools teaching for 17 years, and I've been a director of IT in a number of the schools. So I've got a very I've got a very rich past behind me, in the sense that I'm trained IT teacher, and I mainly taught at years 11 and 12, which is the 2 years before students go on to university or TAFE or further education. And so when I made the move in 2011 to Swinburne, it was only meant to be, it was only a 12-month contract. So there was really no commitment on both ends, so to speak. And it was just there to dip my toes in. I had a Doctor of Education, a PhD behind me, and I thought, look, I'll give this a go. I started in the Faculty of ICT, so Information Communications Technology, and we didn't have an education, we didn't have an education department at Swinburne. So I came in into ICT, and they had money to design and build a course for teachers, primary and secondary school teachers, and the idea was to train them up and give them confidence in educational technologies. So my job in that 12 months was to get the course built, get accreditation through the academic senate of the university, promote the course, get all the content also, and then start promoting it. So the 12-month position then became a 2-year position, and in 2012 I ran the course, and we had about 8 people who signed up. It was quite an expensive course to get people to sign up, so we ran with that. And unfortunately, in 2013, the university had decided that they were going through a cost-cutting exercise, and so any subjects, any courses that had less than 20 in it had a red line put through it. So it wasn't because of the quality of the course, but it was just a numbers game. So anything that wasn't that didn't have enrollments, despite the fact that it was promised that, you know, will take years to build, they pretty much put a line and said, no, that's it. So 2012 was the first and last year that course ran. And so I was then found another, other things to do to see my contract out. And then I was given a 3-year contract in 2014, where I was going to do engagement with schools and with universities and IT and education. And I only stayed for 1 out of the 3 years of that contract. And then in 2015, the university had built up the Department of Education, and they were going to introduce secondary. So I moved over to education in 2015, and I've been in the department since. And towards the end of 2016, I became the deputy chair of the department and have been since then.
What a journey.
So, yes, it's a long-winded explanation to the question you asked. And I'm aware that you've got a second part to the question where you wanted to know, I think, about my areas of interest, my research. And so obviously I've already mentioned to you my background being IT education, so digital technologies, there's many names given to it, computing, digital technologies, emerging technologies. So basically my area of expertise is looking at how technology is used with young children from say preschool right up to year 12. So year 12 is around that 17 years of age, 17, 18. And so we look at how technology is used in the classroom, and I look at it from the perspective of parents, from teachers, from students. And some people are very welcoming of technology, some resist it, some see it as a wonderful thing, others see it as evil. So I look at all these sorts of technologies, and I look at it from the lens of how could it be used in a classroom situation, and the risks, and also how can we minimalize risks, how can we use it for good. And so things such as projects that I've done with humanoid robots, and also with virtual reality in young children. So these are some of the projects. So they're my sort of special interest areas in STEM, obviously, and promoting STEM and girls.
But what made you initially choose to become teacher and choose IT as an area that you obviously now are an expert at?
Yeah, look, that's an interesting one, because I've gone back to, and I've had this question asked of me a number of times, I really go back to my secondary schooling, where I went to school in a small Catholic girls' school, where realistically back in the time, and it's not that far, you know, back, but the school was really backwards to some extent, and it was all about becoming a housewife and being domesticated. So I learned how to cook up to year 11. So I did 5 years of cooking, and I'm actually a pretty good cook, I've got to say. But sewing eluded me. I couldn't sew to save myself. And anyway, I was probably, my mum got an A for sewing for me, I must say, in the early years, but I'm not very good at sewing. But anyway, what I should say is that I didn't feel the need to be a housewife, which is what really they were training us up to be, good little domesticated women that would make a man very happy. So what I really, you know, I was in year 9, and computers was this new area, and the school had bought a lab of computers, but they were always locked away, and it was amazing just to get time with them. And I really felt that I could do something with this. I don't know how to describe it, but I was really energized by these machines. I was very much passionate about what's going on inside of them. How do they work? And it wasn't meant to be that way. You know, girls weren't really meant to be interested. And as I said, it was a small Catholic girls' school, and so they were very traditional. And when I came to year 12, my final year of study, I wanted to study computer science, but the school wouldn't offer it. And so the only way I could study computer science was if I did the subject at a TAFE on a Saturday, and they tried to deter me, but that didn't stop me. And I thought, no, I'm going to do this. So I went off. I did 5 days of schooling at this girls' school, and on the sixth day, on a Saturday, I did the subject, that Year 12 subject, at a TAFE, along with lots of other people. So I ended up doing computing, and obviously, you know, when again going back to this school, the best people, most people could become is a hairdresser, a teacher, a nurse, the traditional jobs that women did. And as I said, quite a number of them worked in offices, and then they, you know, they got married and whatnot. So I guess, you know, that was the best aspiration I could see. And so teaching was really the job I could see in front of me, and obviously computing. So I married the two up. And even when I went to university, I already knew from the moment I stepped in, I wanted to be an IT teacher, a computing teacher. And one of the disappointments was that they said to me, you can't just be an IT teacher. You have to have something else. You have to come out with two methods.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, no, I just want IT. And anyway, I had to do something else. So I chose the less of all the other evils. I chose mathematics. And so I ended up doing computing and mathematics at university. And the ironic thing is that when I did get a job as a computer teacher, I never really taught mathematics. They only
Oh.
wanted my IT.
Oh,
So
there you are.
all that work for really nothing to some extent.
Amazing, absolutely amazing. So, a little bit going back to when you provided professional development workshop in IT for teachers in schools. You know, thinking back, how receptive were teachers to IT then, and do you think this has changed today?
Yeah, look, again, a great question. So, pretty much understanding the time when I became a teacher in the mid 90s. And so, in Victoria, in Melbourne, particularly in Australia, the situation was that we were coming into a recession. And so, jobs were very tight. It was very hard to get ongoing jobs, particularly in schools. We had a government that had contracts for teachers and they were getting rid of teachers. So, everything was very unsettled. It was a difficult period of time. So, when I came into teaching, it was hard to get an ongoing job. And I started off with contracts. So, it was a term contract here, half a year there, then 12 months, then 2 years, and then eventually I got ongoing. And so with the economy contracting, so getting smaller, teachers were not moving from one job to another, and because it was hard to get jobs, people were staying. And so what ended up happening was that you had a band of teachers who might have left teaching or might have moved into something else, but they stayed in the profession. And so they were then having to be redeployed into areas to teach. And there was a lot of demand for computing in the 90s. And so they were just putting anybody to plug the holes in teaching computing. So, oh, you like computers? Wonderful. You can actually teach computers. No sort of afterthought of, there's theory behind it, there's a methodology, there's a real understanding of it. It was just, oh, you're enthusiastic. Fantastic. You can teach computers to the year nine kids or the year eight, whatever's. And so what ended up happening was that you had a whole heap of teachers who just didn't sort of come from an understanding of how to teach it. And so, this is where I sort of came in. So I was, even though I was doing contract work until I ended up getting ongoing employment, I also worked with the subject association. And by that, I mean I didn't get paid by the subject association to work for them. I was pretty much a volunteer, and occasionally they would pay for my time, but that wasn't the motivation. So, because I actually came from a real understanding of computers and I understood how to teach at years 11 and 12, and I was teaching years 11 and 12, I was then running professional development for teachers how to teach the subject appropriately. So, I remember I would have been probably about 22, 23, young female. And I'm teaching a room full of males who were middle-aged or older. And here I was, looking back, I sort of think to myself, my God, how did I do that? Some young person coming in, telling others how to do this and teaching. But I did really well. I didn't alienate people. I worked with them. I worked with them even after, running professional development. And so the teachers were very receptive to it. Obviously, they were receptive because they turned up, and most of the stuff that we ran were on weekends. So they were quite receptive. They wanted to do, good by their students. They wanted to do the best by them. So they were learning how to do these things. I mean, I fast forward now, the last probably 8 or 9 years at Swinburne, where I've run professional development. I don't run it as much in terms of how to teach the subject, because obviously I've moved on. But I have run things like how to use humanoid robots, or I've done how to teach the new subject when courses have been revisited or changed because of accreditation purposes. So I have done those sorts of things. So it's sort of evolved with time.
Do you think there how receptive teachers are? Did you see any difference? I mean, you talk about you had mainly men that you were teaching.
Unfortunately, and it still is to this day, IT is very much a male-centered you know, industry. And so, you know, when you look at the figures now, one in five people are women who do IT as a, you know, tertiary course. And in the workforce, it's somewhere around hovering around the 20% mark in terms of women. So IT is very much, and was and still is, very much a male-centric industry.
So how do you change it?
Look, I wish I had the answer. I'm doing a lot of research in this area, but and there's been a lot of research done in the past, but no one seems to have the right answer. I mean, there's getting role models, but that's only one part of it. It's getting girls involved, but getting girls involved at a level where they're at a younger age. So in terms of, we know that the literature says that girls between grades 5 and year 8, that's where they, and even boys, I should say, that's where they start thinking about their careers and what they want to be. And this is where they get exposure to things. So, you know, exposure to, say, computer programming, exposure to robotics, exposure to role models. If they can see what field is about, they can have some understanding. But this is a very compounded area as well, because if you take a step back, we have a national curriculum in Australia, which is obviously called the Australian curriculum, and we have a unit that is called digital technologies, which is a compulsory unit, but it's only taught for a very small amount of time. And I'm gonna look at the primary school teachers, for example. The primary school teachers who become primary school teachers, they're not necessarily computer scientists. They don't have a background in computing. And the course requires a certain amount of understanding of how to create algorithms, what goes on inside a computer, and also how to program. And if teachers aren't comfortable or don't know how to do this, then that insecurity is passed on to the students and that love is not there. So we do have an issue in terms of developing teachers' confidence in that area of technology. And, you know, if we're going to go to technology, why stop there? Why don't we do it for science, technology, design and mathematics? So why don't we do it for the whole STEM, the four STEM areas?
And, you know, when you talk about the confidence, lack of confidence, it sounds like there is still lack of maths confidence among teachers.
Absolutely. So it's not, you know, as I said, it's not just the IT, it's the mathematics. And a lot of the primary school teachers, they haven't necessarily gone on to university to do a science degree or a mathematics degree. They've done a very generalist course, and then they're expected to teach specialised areas, which they don't necessarily have the background for.
Thinking about the projects that you are working on, can you share some of the current projects?
Yeah, look, there's one in particular, actually there's two that I can think of, that really, I think, you know, step beautifully in terms of what we just talked about. So one of the projects is about primary school teachers and STEM. And so, again, it's about building that confidence for primary school teachers so that they are confident to teach the sciences, the technologies, engineering and math. So I've got, I've received some funding from a wonderful philanthropy organisation. And what they did was they provided money so that we can actually do this, as in build a hub. And in the hub, we have things such as resources. So some of the resources that are mapped to the Australian curriculum, and these are free resources. These are ones that I haven't created. Then we're creating 40 resources, 10 for science, 10 for technology, 10 for engineering, and 10 for mathematics. And these resources are like teacher plans or lesson plans, for a better word, but it's a very detailed lesson plan about the materials and making science fun and understanding particular concepts. And what we're doing is, as part of these resources, we're also going to be creating professional 2 to 3 minute videos that encapsulate what the teacher resource is, so that when teachers look at it, they can go, ah, yeah, okay, and they can understand it in 2 to 3 minutes. We are aware that teachers are time poor. They don't have 10 minutes or 20 minutes to watch one video about how to do something. So we're trying to condense it down into very small chunks to help the teachers, you know, conduct these lessons. And what we've also done is, with each of these resources, we differentiate. So what's this like to teach, say, with young children, say from foundation to grade one? How can you teach this to, say, grade two or grade three kids? How can you teach this to the older primary school kids, like in grade five, grade six? So we've differentiated how the actual resource can be taught so that teachers can, adapt to the class they're in. The last part of the project is creating professional development, an online course for teachers in terms of how to teach STEM, and that's something we're working on at the moment.
That sounds so fascinating. Can I just ask you then, how do you measure the confidence that these teachers are confident, when they finish completed the course?
Yeah, look, at the moment, what we've done is we're trying to get baseline data from teachers across Victoria in terms of how confident they are to teach STEM. We're asking principals, where do they go to get STEM resources? What kind of competitions are available? What do they do at their school? And we're asking parents as well. So we've targeted three different groups. Then once we actually get the course happening, and we're going to work with a couple of schools as well to trial it, we would like to collect baseline data there as well, and also data at the end when they've actually done the course. And so we'd like to then be able to say, look, based on what they came in with and what they've finished up with, this is the improvement.
Do you, I'm thinking about COVID and the pandemic. Therese, do you think we have seen the back of the pandemic? And if not, what are your concerns?
Look, I'm sort of in two minds about this one, because whilst I guess the society is now vaccinated, so from the pandemic point of view, it's still ravaging outside, but it's not as severe. I mean, in Melbourne, for example, in Victoria, we had lockdowns when we were in the 100 cases. Now we're in the thousands, and we've just let it go. Obviously, it's not as severe as what it used to be, but it's still there. So I think we have to be very mindful. But it's really the consequences of COVID that we're seeing now in schools particularly. So the consequences, I guess what I'm thinking of, for example, is for the last 2 years, a lot of Melburnians have been locked away. And my understanding is that we were one of the harshest places in the world to be locked. So we were locked far longer than anywhere else. And so by being locked away, and when I mean locked away, you weren't able to socialize with people, you weren't able to go out to restaurants, things like that. And so humans being social creatures did not interact with one another closely as what we normally do. So things like the flu, common colds, things like that, they were dormant because it wasn't being spread, because you were really confined to your own household. So now that we're sort of moving into winter and it's really cold and wet, we're finding that people are getting sick more often, not necessarily with COVID, but they're getting the flu, they're getting colds, they're just getting things that we haven't seen for the last 2 years. And this is particularly hitting classrooms. My youngest daughter was telling me that half her class were away, and I said to her, do you think they had COVID? And she shrugged her shoulders and said, no, I think they've just got a cold. And so, when half the class is away and a teacher is away, because a lot of the teachers aren't there either, they're sick or they've got household contacts that aren't very well, it's becoming a case of how does society function?
Yes.
How does a school function? And we've heard about schools where they're collapsing a couple of classes together so that they can maintain students coming to school. But then you've got to say, well, if you're collapsing classes together, you're putting heaps of students together. Isn't that also a super spreader way of getting colds and flus if people are unwell? You've got parents who are, you know, have had enough of having disrupted work lives as well. And no doubt there'll be parents who'll just say, oh, look, yeah, look, don't worry about your runny nose, just go, you'll be fine. You know, going back to what it used to be. And then you just don't know that other people are catching things. So I think it's more the byproducts of COVID now that we're seeing, and the disruption that that's having, in particular in classrooms and in schools, and you know, the lack of, I guess, emergency teachers, and just having that mobile workforce ready to sort of come in. So whilst the kids are not being disrupted from COVID, I think there's disruptions in classrooms, through the byproducts.
So, what impact do you think COVID has had on higher education and especially student teachers in their year, and who may have missed out on, for example, professional experiences in schools?
Yeah, look, I think COVID has really been difficult for many higher education institutions, and particularly I'm thinking of the Victorian context where you know, university was pretty much online. Students couldn't come in because of the, you know, the lockdown, the severe lockdown. But if you think about teachers as in service, sorry, not in service, pre-service teachers. Particularly those who are doing a Master of Teaching, a 2-year degree, and they have a condensed or intense teaching schedule where they might have three, say, rounds of teaching rounds. Their first, and you know, some of these students would have started in 2020 when COVID first began. Some of these student teachers may not have even had a placement in a school, so they've only done their teaching, you know, their teaching practice online. Which is very different to going into a classroom and managing student behavior, managing multiple priorities, managing you know, hands up and answering questions, establishing a discussion. I mean, we all know, even as academics, where we try to have discussions with our students online. Many of them turn their camera off, they turn their mic off, or they tell you that their mic's not working, their camera's not working. And so it was very hard to instill discussion amongst students. So I think I do really, I am really concerned because whilst institutions did all they could to try and make sure that they could give their student teachers the ability to have practical experience in some form or another, I do think that the student teachers have missed out on authentic, real placements in terms of being in a classroom, being in a school, understand the dynamics, you know, working with bells, all those fundamental things that make working in a classroom or working in a school so unique to the for their own needs.
Okay. So coming to the final question, is there anything you want to add that I have not mentioned and is of special importance to you?
Look, I'm one who's very curious, and I love the whole idea of, you know, speaking with you, particularly given your experiences in Sweden. And you know, I'm one who tends to like to know a bit more about what's happening in the world. So I guess if there's any opportunities to explore what happens elsewhere, and particularly in this digital technology space, I would be really, really happy to have people reach out and talk to me because I'm very fascinated and very interested.
Wonderful. You know, and I'm going to be able to provide your contact details on the podcast introductory page.
Fantastic, that's great.
Thank you so much, Therese, and have a fabulous week.
You too, Lisa. I've really enjoyed being on this today, so thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. And of course, I'm not podcasting from Sweden because I am currently in Melbourne here in Australia, where I will be doing a few more recordings and interviews with fascinating academics and researchers. But till next time, take care of yourself and each other's. Bye for now.